Okay, very well. I think if it's okay with you all, I'm not going to use the podium. Is that okay? Might help each keep us all a little more awake. The papers that were passed out, turn all the way to the back, and I want you all to do a little exercise. I'd like for you to draw a T, but with drooping ears on the T. So draw a line down the middle and then draw a little bit of a roof. Kind of like if you were looking here and there was a middle line here and then the roof, a little bit of a roof. And then we want to have four right down the middle on each side of the middle line. Just make some marks because we're going to write some stuff in there. We want to have four columns. Okay? So a T with a little bit of a drooping roof with little lines for four columns. In the first column on the left, write on top individuals, and the one right in the middle, write families, the one that's right beside on the left side of the post, the center post. On the right side of the center post, write employees, and on all the way to the right, put at the top, on the top line. So you know, identify the columns. And then the last one is businesses. So you have individuals, families, employees, and businesses. And the individuals and the families are in the center. So when an individual is born, what does he need? What are some of the things that an individual needs? He needs family, which that's the next column, and he usually kind of automatically gets, he needs food. Anything else?
Shelter.
He needs a little bit of diapers, and he needs some training, right? Okay. Now, on the family side, what do we need? Kind of the same thing, right? We need food, shelter, and the number of things. But on the family column, what do we have in some of those categories? Like, what are some things that you have when you have shelter? What is contained in that shelter? So you have a house. What's inside the house?
Furnishings.
So you have a refrigerator. So we could put refrigerator in there. Do you have a wash machine? Yeah, probably most of you have a wash machine. Or how many of you still wash your clothes out in the creek on the stones? You have a table. You have a number of things. An individual needs all of that as well, right? So families, yeah, if someone needs, does everyone have a copy? So we have learned, one of the things that we have learned is that an individual also needs a washing machine, a table, a bed, a roof, a car, everything that a family needs. However, if we were to all live as an individual, how costly would it be? It would be cost prohibitive for an individual to have individually all of those things. And so we have the family unit. Now, we don't necessarily think about it that much because God instituted a family. Now, obviously, to have a family, you have to have two people. Like, there's no way you can get around having a family. Like, we were generally speaking here now again, okay? So, generally, you have to have a man and a woman agree that they're going to have a family. And so now they have all of those items. Now, what is the most important item in a family? Talking on the business side, what is the most important thing for a family? Okay, everybody agreed that it's income? Okay, he doesn't agree with you. And I don't either. Now, income is gonna play a very important role, but you know the famous saying that if hard work and ingenuity would make you rich, all the women in Africa would be millionaires. Okay? So you don't need a whole lot of money to live, to survive. So what is kind of the basis for a family, besides all the things that we live with? What makes it work? Love is another thing. But you know, living on dreams ain't easy. Commitment. Okay. There's something that we have a hard time identifying.
Should not work.
You're getting close. Donated time. Do you understand how much value each family enjoys on donated time? If you have a whole bunch of donated time, you understand how much gardening you can do, how much income you can raise when you don't have to pay someone. How much does mom get paid for washing the clothes, cleaning the house? Like, tremendous amount of donated time. And then the children come in and they provide a tremendous amount of donated time. And then dad, he comes home after he's worked his 40 hours. He comes and donates a whole bunch of time. Well, we all get free 24 hours a day. Why shouldn't we donate at least a good portion of it? So on this side of individuals, and if an individual tries to live by himself, he has his own house, he has his own car, he has everything, and then he has to provide his own income. Well, guess what? He's probably going to have to pay someone to come clean his house because he's not going to have time. He's going to have to sub out a lot of the work that a family can operate on donated time. Now, this is the interesting part. On the other side, where you have employees and businesses, nobody wants to donate their time. Nobody wants to donate their time. Families are successful because we have this astronomical amount of donated time. Just try to get an employee to donate some time to your business. Yes. In fact, they're constantly saying they're not getting enough. So businessmen, I just wanted to bring that out because we do have a little section that we kind of like to start out. At the bottom, we have the man carrying this huge stone, and then you have the fella that's just, and I should have just put it right at the bottom of this page, where you have the man that's just whistling along and he has no load. Why? Because somebody is always paying. Somebody always has to pay. And business owners understand that. A lot of the population does not understand that in the business world, it just doesn't work. You can't operate a business on donated time. So we usually like to do that thing. Everybody agrees it's impossible for us to all live individually. It would become cost prohibitive and we wouldn't have the time. We couldn't even keep up all of the things that we enjoy. We would have to hire it out, and then by that time we would probably spend as much money as what we make, and then it just works living in a family. And in fact, they say in the U.S., I don't think us Mennonites understand the epidemic, but in our 300 or 400 million people here in the U.S., it's becoming a huge burden. Children don't want to leave mom and dad because it's so much cheaper to live with mom and dad. A lot of them have a hard time getting them to move out and provide for themselves. Usually in the Anabaptist circles, like, we want to leave as quick as possible. I don't understand what it is. Maybe it's because so much hard work is required out of us. Anyways, we'll let that go. It's just the interesting fact that most people never take in the equation of donated time and how much our economy and how much our families revolve around that. So, a few things, and I don't know some of the question that they put here for this next session is business really the best model for financial freedom in new communities? Like, why do they have to put such a question that you hardly can answer, okay? And then, isn't business a distraction from the real purpose of building the church? Like, what do you say? It's just some very hard questions. Abraham. So let's look. I want to look at five things in the Bible. Abraham and Lot. Guess what happened? Abraham and Lot, they were very good friends. They went off on this journey by them with their families, and they kept on having children. And their servants kept on having children. Amazing, isn't it? And with all that free labor, living as a family, they began to have a bunch of sheep and a bunch of cattle, and all of a sudden, their current situation was completely disrupted because it was too much, it says. Huh. Well, to fix the problem, just never have too much. Right? They could have decided that they're not going to disrupt this relationship they had. Let's keep this thing, let's quit having children, let's quit raising more servants, let's quit having more sheep, because we don't want to disrupt this little thing that we started out with. You know, this little nice relationship that we started out with. So what was the fault of Lot and Abraham's division? They kept on doing what God's plan was. They kept on replenishing the earth, and with having more children and having more servants, you could do a little bit more, but all of a sudden we needed to divide. Good. That's good. God says that's good. And guess what we say? We say that's terrible. Like, we let business disrupt our comfortable situation that we were in. Isaac. So I'm talking about the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. So I want to see what happened with their business thing. Isaac. It says he planted, and he was with Abimelech, and they got their troubles fixed. And it says that he went out and he planted, and what was his harvest?
A hundredfold.
A hundredfold, mind you. Now, God should have known that that's going to disrupt the whole system. Why would God give you a hundredfold when you should stay a little bit poor, because you're a little more spiritual when you're poor, right? Well, it says that he got a hundredfold, and what did the neighbor say? This is not looking good for us. This man is becoming mighty. And they had all kinds of stuff they said. Isaac didn't say much. But now, since he had a little bit of something, guess what? He had a vision to do what? A couple verses later, what did he do? What did he say? There had something been destroyed that his father had done. And he said, look, we need to bring this back. What was it? Digging wells. So what did he do? He dug one well up, and if nobody would have bothered him, he probably would have stayed with that one well, right? Right away. Jealousy from the neighbors. Oh dear. Isn't that the messiness? One of the things that we need to understand, there is nothing more messy than business development. Business development is the most messiest thing that you can do. And let's just be okay with it. So he dug out one well, they took it, yeah, no problem. So he went and dig another one, they took it away, no problem. Dig another one, no problem. Dig another one, no problem. Finally, he dug one and they didn't strive over it. And he said, whoo, finally we have room in the land. Isn't that what business does? Makes room in the land. He did not stop digging one well and then another well and another well. He knew that that's what the community needed. They needed all those wells. And so he never lost his vision. Even though it caused strife and jealousy every time, he could have said, oh, well, I'm going to quit this mission project because no success here. Oh, well, try it again. No success here, no success here, no success here. No, he knew that to make room in the land, you need to keep on. Like, you need to keep on. Because the community needed it. Jacob. Sure glad I didn't have to be in Jacob's shoes. I mean, I was, most of my life, I was an employee. but my boss never paid me enough. But I never had a boss that pulled my leg as much as what Jacob's boss did. Like every time that it was going in the favor of the employee, he would switch the wages, and then it would still go good, and he'd switch. And Jacob said, "Oh, you changed my wages 10 times. Well, that's the messiness of a business. You are constantly going to have issues with your employees. It's just the messiness of business. Then we have Job. Good old Job. Natural disasters. You know, he had this disaster. He didn't know what was behind the natural disasters. All he could see was that this was a natural disaster. How many of you think that the wildfires in Hollywood is something really good that's happening out there? Now, to be politically correct, don't raise your hands, okay? Job had no idea what was going on, but he had a natural disaster, natural disaster, natural disaster. And that is part of the messiness of business, is all of these things that you can't control that really mess with your business. Really mess with your business. But hey, you know, you're going to end up with double at the end, so let's not worry about natural disasters, right? All natural disasters end up with double at the end. Didn't hear no amens on that one. You know, that's the messiness part of business. Sometimes a natural disaster will just simply take out a business, and there's not really anything you can do about it. But that's where you need brotherhood and community to step in as well. So, those were the things that just make business messy. Number one, it divides families. Businesses divides families. Just even a natural, normal growth of business, just like Abraham and Lot experienced, it ended up dividing their family. It ended up splitting their family. Jacob or Isaac, hey, let's keep going. Bible says, he that falls 7 times and gets back up. It's not the falling, it's the getting back up that's important. But if it's something that the community needs, keep doing it. And Jacob, you know, Just bear the messiness of business. You know, he was there with Laban, and they were just, you know, it was just messy. It was just like really, really messy. And then you have Job. He did everything correctly. And then natural disasters struck, or what to him looked like natural disasters. But he was faithful, and in the end, it says, God gave him twice as much as he had before. And now what do you do? That is the question that I was last night. What happens? What does a soul do when someone all of a sudden ends up with a lot more than what he used to have? Because a lot of times when you see people end up with a lot more than what they have, God is very clear with the children of Israel. Once you get to Canaan, and once you get to a place where you have houses and lands that you did not work for, remember, once you have twice as much as what you used to have in the desert, your tendency is to forget me. What do you do with a child that tends to forget to obey? As parents, we all know how that works. Sometimes they have to be helped with their memory. Okay, a lot of you have been asking about our model, and we don't want to prolong a lot of things here today. But that was one of the things that the mission groups asked us in our meeting that Gary mentioned about. What are you all planning to do different than what we do that makes you think that it can work, that mission sustainability through business can work? And we just didn't know. And neither after 5 years do we know what the business success rate will be. But I trust that we take the view that Isaac took in well digging, is if it is something that our communities need, let's keep doing till there's room in the land. That makes sense? Let's keep doing till there's room in the land. And up to this point, we have, and I'm not sure how much comment I should make on this or not, but up to this point, the little diagram that we drew on the back here, the little diagram we drew, usually what we like to tell people is, so businessmen provides jobs for the employees provide the majority of the expenses for families. And the business people get very little credit for providing for all the others before it. And I shared that example. Most people do not realize that in the advanced country of the United States of America, there's only 7 to 8% of the people that provide all of the economy, the foundation for our economy. And it's just really, really hard for them to grasp that. But there is a crucial piece on the employee side. Good employees are the foundation of good business. The employee and the employer should have the same commitment as mom and pop on the family side. I don't want to be married to my employer. Okay, well, yeah. But we need that commitment. If we could have the appreciation and commitment on the employee-employer side, same as we have with individual and families, the appreciation between mom and pop and the individuals and understand how a family system works, we would be light years ahead on the business side. But so often the businesses are criticized because it seems like the only thing they can think about doing is developing their business. And they don't really have interest in missions. They don't go do missions. They just don't become very much involved. With us really appreciating and saying, but that is what gives the rest of us jobs that we can tithe, and then they're also the ones that give us time off to go to El Salvador when there was an earthquake there. That was part of the things I enjoyed in my youth. So the model that we put together, and so as well, a lot of people don't understand that we're actually in a position where we're actually giving business owners opportunity to use some of their extra money to develop other businesses and kind of do this as from all of the noise and ruckus asking for donations, which they often are the ones that provide either employees with jobs that they can donate or they donate themselves. But this is an actual, what I have seen over the last 5 years, people that are business-minded, you can feel the appreciation that there's actually an organization where I can put some of my money in that I don't have designated for donations, and I can use that to develop other businessmen in other parts of the world, not just here in the U.S., and then get my money back, Lord willing. And so it is a little bit of a different, like we're not used to, our Anabaptist communities are not used to the Anabaptist savings and loans idea, and especially on the international side. They feel, it has amazed me. So I lived 26 years outside of the U.S., and 34 years inside the U.S., it has amazed me at how extremely comfortable and safe people feel in the U.S. And they look at the rest of the world as a very treacherous place, a place where you could just anytime disappear, get kidnapped, get, with the cartels and the mafia, and you can, like, it's dangerous out there, and especially on the money side, like, we could lose our money. It's been kind of humorous how real people, a real fear people have that we, like, if our money leaves the U.S., we're going to lose it. And having lived in four different cultures, I grew up Amish, and we joined the beaches, and which that's a whole culture in itself. And I took first, second, and third, part of third grade in the Old Colony Mennonite school system, so I talk High German as well. And then, of course, we had to learn Spanish, and lived here in the U.S. The last 5 years, I've worked fairly close with conference people. I didn't know what these conference people were like, you know. That's a whole culture in itself as well. And so you get to know all of these cultures, and it became very understandable. And I mentioned it last night. Every person, every culture, every country has their uniqueness, and some things that work here absolutely do not work here. It's just the way it is. And the better we can navigate those differences, the better it works. Okay, the asylum model. So how can you keep our money safe? That's always what businessmen ask. How can you keep, like, how safe is our money? How safe is our money? They work for it, and that's a legitimate question. How safe is our money? So we put together the accountability. We try to keep a system that's very simple and yet very doable and does what we want it to do, but doesn't cause undue confusion on the other side. So number one, we usually have some conversation with the deacon. Now this is interesting. Deacons often are like, they're very intrigued how we could help their situations. So maybe, I'm not sure, maybe we should talk with, because deacons tend to be very favorable to this program. What was the first thing I said that a business does? It divides families. Just understand that. A lot of deacons don't understand actually what happens when you begin to do some business development in their community. So we do start off with the deacons. Number two, they need to be in agreement with the Directed Confession of Faith.
It's not 1963.
It's not 1963? Okay, that was which year then? 1632. Nope, that's good, because we can edit that. You can mark that out and write in there 1632. Okay.
1963 was the Guard Street.
Oh, okay. So that then the year is right.
Well, in our applications, it says compliant with the 1963 Confession of Faith.
Oh, Confession.
It doesn't have Doctrine.
Okay.
So it's the revised, newest.
Cross out the word Doctrine. Okay.
It's what we send out to the.
Sure. Good. Okay, number three is a clear property title, clear of any liens, valued 20% more than the loan. So this was a thing that was very amazing to us. A lot of our missions say you can't get clear titles, you can't, like, it's just there with a little bit of help. Normally you can get all of that stuff worked out. So we knew that there needed to be some teeth to business development. And then, of course, a first-degree mortgage lien on a clear title. So if someone signs off a first-degree mortgage, which is what all banks require in those countries as well, most of these countries have adopted the banking standards of the World Bank. And so it's not a court case item. If you voluntarily sign off your name on a first degree lien, that gets paid off, no questions asked, before you can have your title clear. Number six, and here is something that has been very interesting for us, is we require that you disclose all private and personal and commercial loans. And we have been amazed at the network of little loans a lot of these people have. They'll have a little bit from aunt and uncle and so on, but then usually the biggest issue is things haven't went the way they wanted it to, and they haven't been able to keep the word and paying it back. And so now you have a lying missionary. That's how they're perceived from this side up here. Like, you're a missionary, you should be paying us back just like you said you would. However, and so it begins to, so it's not just businesses that divide families. Well, in this case, yeah, a business loan would have divided the family. But a lot of people appreciate that they can go back home now to the family reunion and actually feel comfortable in going back. And so we do require that they disclose everything, and they either have to, number seven, they either have to be consolidated under one loan or have to have a signed contract. And it is amazing how many families will give money, a cousin, an aunt, or uncle will give money with no written contract. So they have to disclose those, and then they have to have a signed contract from the third party on loan conditions and payback. They have to come to an agreement of what the loan conditions are and the payback. And then number eight, a personal loan guarantee also signed. And number nine, UCCs also on equipment if needed. So you see the teeth now? When you sign a property over, you are saying that property will be sold to satisfy the ASAL debt. And it brings serious thinking. Am I willing to give up that piece of property if this doesn't work out? Now, we don't just do number one through nine and then just leave it at that. You can have all the teeth in the world that you want to put in, but you got to give some tools. So number 10 is, we have the four pillars of business. So organizational, operational, financial, and marketing and sales. If you turn the page, we have the definition of the four pillars. The definition on the organizational is legal structure, operational chart, organizational chart, or org chart, human resources, tax strategy, talent retention, leadership development, and employee engagement and risk management. And all of those, we help you walk through those, whether it's on the organizational, operational, and the financial, and the marketing and sales. Number 12, you have to develop a 3 to 5 year business plan with healthy projections in there. And you also need to operate on an annual financial budget, which means you have to put in, you have to figure out, or you have to kind of prophesy what you're gonna do the next. Now, some people have a good gift of prophecy. Some people don't. They prophesy amazing things, and it never happens. Implement a complete QuickBooks chart of account. And we give the training for that, help you get that set up. Receive complete training on entering information into QuickBooks. And number 16, you sign up for monthly visit by an ASAL accountability coach, whether it's via video call or whether it's in person. And here is the one that hurts the most, is reconciling QuickBooks on a monthly basis. Now, if you don't think that is a hard thing to do, just become an accountability coach for a cell. Reconciling on a monthly basis. But you know, that has proved to be our most, the best way to keep people on the straight and narrow is you gotta reconcile your books on a monthly basis. How many parents, how many aunts and uncles, how many mission boards required, when you got a loan from any of those, required a monthly visit and reconciling of their books on the monthly basis? Everybody would give a little bit and then they would go to the uttermost parts of the world hoping that you would never come back and ask for more. Okay, turn to page number 18. We have a chart of covenants that you need to sign. Something that you will commit to, that if you get out of these guardrails, you will put a correction plan in place. So, what is the loan covenants that you sign? Cash, near cash versus liability. We'd like to see 1-to-1. We'd like to see you have as much cash as what your liabilities are, or current liabilities. If it goes down to half, then if it goes below half, you trigger a correction action plan. And then it just goes all the way down. And here is the interesting thing. Net profit. So we have two of those, 10%. And this is where a lot of people ask, what are you going to do with the people when they have double of what they had before? We usually are very clear with them. Once your business, after with a real business set up, where dad gets a salary that he can supply his, that he can supply his family, and he pays his employees decent wages, and he has a 10% profit margin. Once it goes over 10% profit margin, we are very specific with them that we want this to begin to go into your local schools or local projects for the community. And that takes, deflates some of this, because we are very, very aware that once people have double, that things go south really, really fast. And so we have this conversation with them, and they have it in their signed covenant that once it gets to 10%, it's considered a healthy business, and if it goes over 10%, you need to do something in your community. And we will usually try to set that right up. Right out the gate. If you get out of these guardrails, number 19, a correction plan is implemented. And number 20, we have this program. It's called Fathom. And we can dump in just information straight out of QuickBooks. If your QuickBooks is in order, we just, by the click of a button, we can dump it into this Fathom program. And this tells you, if you keep going the way you're going to end up over here, or you're going to end up over here. Like it is saying, if you keep going the way you're going, what does the Bible say? He that puts his hand on the plow and looks back is not fit. You know what most businesses do? Oh, they look at the last quarter. Wow, we had a really good quarter. And I think I'm going to buy me a new John Deere. And so, they all, like, if you look back on the past, you make extremely foolish future decisions. If you have something that tells you, okay, we take 2 years of history and we crunch those numbers, and it's saying, if you continue on the way you are, 6 months down the road, you're going to be off course. People make way better decisions. So they get this report on a monthly basis that shows exactly which ones that are in the green and which one is on the red. It's an extremely useful tool, and we really don't have to do anything, but it's not cheap. Obviously, the programmers knew the value of that. And then 21, 2 years of training, EOS, having good meetings on a weekly, quarterly, and yearly basis. How many friends and family have taught the people that they gave loans to how to have profitable weekly, quarterly, and yearly business meetings? And then the last part is implement teaching on community development. We didn't want to just do business, but neither did we want to take over responsibility for the communities, but we also wanted to put a tool in their hand that they have something that they can do. So we have the seven pillars of kingdom, sustainable kingdom communities. Now you could add a lot of pillars to that. You know, more isn't necessarily better, and less isn't necessarily better. Seven is kind of a nice number. So we chose seven of those. And the two that we really work on as a SAL is the individual pillar and then the sustainable businesses, because those two we do have to take responsibility for. Now, the education, which is in the middle, the teaching, like, we can share some of that, but most of the time we feel that's the church responsibility. For the education side of it, we will help on the business side of it, but healthy education is important, and they need to understand that as well. Then, of course, healthy families and healthy churches, we assume that the churches are going to do that. The communities are going to take responsibility for that. And then you have the two on the right, which is mutual aid organizations, which what we know up here as health share programs. You know, we have Mennonite Motorist Aid. We have Property CAM, which is the property side of it. Those all help to make our communities healthy. And I appreciated what Thomas said about the kangaroo scene of his community. Like, the kangaroo hopped through there. All the places where insurance wasn't done yet, but where the mutual aid was present was already put back into order. So then you have the civic organizations, which is some of the things that we're involved in here in the U.S. is like search and rescue, first response for disaster, and a few of those things that can be very healthy for communities. And then we have the seven definitions, and as you can see in number 24 there, it gives the church and whoever is looking into that, gives them a little bit of the things that they need to focus on, which is vision, mission, core value, and purpose, which is the same for all seven of them. And then the other four are some additional for different ones. But the very last page, number 25, is an interesting exercise. It is simple yet profound. You have people, you can take any of those pillars and any of those definitions, and you can put it in, and ask that person, what is your current position? What's your current position on your personal vision? What's your current position on your vision or your mission or your core values? And then have them write, you know, we have room there for seven, but you don't have to fill in seven. But what is your vision? What is your personal vision, actually? And then you go to the last one. Well, what must be true to achieve that objective? And then you have in between there the strategy. What must you do to achieve that? And if you take that through all of the pillars on all of the subjects and you try to get at least 5 to 7 items, it's amazing the clarity it brings to a person's mind. And it's such a simple, it's like, what's your current position? Like, just be honest with yourself. What is your current position with your church? You know, what's your current position with your neighbor? What's your current position with yourself or your vision? And like, where would you like that to be? And what must you do to achieve that? So we've tried to keep it as simple as possible, yet bring the results that is desired. That is the ASAL business accountability. Some people, they go over this and, whew, these people are going to learn way more than what we're going to learn here in the U.S. And I'm like, good, because we want young families, young men. We just sent a 30-year-old single New Order Amish fella down to Mexico to help set up a rice dryer. And we all know the work ethics of our Amish friends, and he went down there, and he did like we normally do. He worked day and night and a half, and he got it, did an excellent job, and his testimony is, wow, that was such an interesting experience for him. You know, he had the work ethics, but all of a sudden he was driving a little moped around this little Mexican town, you know, and he couldn't talk Spanish, but he was there involved in the project, and he just immersed himself in the Mexican culture. And he was just really, it was a really new experience. We were like, whew, you just were a real big blessing to us because you went down there and got stuff done. Because you all know kind of how it goes in the Latin countries. But those are the opportunities. And we're like, you know, if there's a system that we can get, you know, maybe some young couples, maybe they have interest in going 2-3 months on a business development plan, and they get trained in all of these things, you know, they might be able to come back home and have a little different view of business and have a little different view of the world. Those of us that have lived outside of the U.S. do have a little bit of different view of the world. But it's ironic, those of us that have lived in other countries, we are probably less critical to the U.S. than the U.S. is on themselves. Because you're just people like the rest of us. But you have tremendous more opportunity. And a lot of people don't do their statistics. For example, why do all the Mexicans want to come to the United States? Mexico is the same size as the 5 largest states here in the U.S. California, Texas, New Mexico, Montana or Oregon. You know, take some of the five largest states in the U.S. equals the size of Mexico. But Mexico's GDP is 1.2, and Texas, one state's GDP, is 1.8. So why wouldn't they want to come? They have way more opportunity. The people in the U.S. have no clue that when you live in a country where you equal one-third of the world's economy, you have a tremendous amount of opportunities that no one else has. And that is why most of us usually end up coming back here to the U.S. to make ends meet. We moved to Paraguay in 1967. We ran out of money, and my dad came up and worked a couple months. 5 years later, we really ran out of money, came back up as a family. We're here 2 years. That's when I learned English. We went back down for 8 years. By that time, I was 17. But at age 14, a little bit before that, my father decided that our community needed some income, so he convinced the community. We had no electric. We were just living in the jungle with no electric, but we had some animals and things. He convinced the neighborhood that we all get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and milk the cows, a couple cows that we had. Each one had a couple cows. And by 5 o'clock, we put the milk together. We started out with 6 milk cans. And at 5 o'clock, he would drive 2 hours to sell the warm milk. 3 years later, he was killed in an accident delivering milk. By that time, it was close to 3,000 liters. Semi came across the road, and he was killed instantly. I was age 14. We had about 150, 160 acres of jungle, about 10 acres cleared. And there was, of course, I am big for my age, so I was 14 years old, but I could do a man's day's worth of work. I worked 3 years from age 14 to 17. And I had just got out of school. It wasn't hard for us to see that we were slowly going into bankruptcy. So at age 17, my family said, Roman, you're going to have to go to the U.S. Why? Because there's opportunity. And make some money, pay off the debt, and make some extra and come back. By that time, I had enough misery, went through it. By age 17, I had went through enough down, Amish, back, joined the beaches, back down, loss of father, went into bankruptcy at age 17. I came up here and just felt really cozy up here. And so I stayed. My wife and I went back then for service sometime later. But it's cozy up here. It's nice. I worked as an employee. By the time I was 17, I realized that it takes a lot of wisdom and energy to run a farm and things, and like being an employee was just very comfortable. What am I saying by that? A couple months ago, I went back down, did a tour. The Mennonites took the milk project on from my father. They had a meeting about a year after, and they said, this model is not going to work. What do? We shut it down, or should we try processing our milk? So they voted to start processing. They bought one little machine that could pasteurize the milk and put it right into a plastic 1-liter bag. That's how they started out. When they gave me the tour this last time, they are producing between 1.3 and 1.4 million liters a day. They have totally flooded the whole milk market in Paraguay, and they are exporting about as much milk as what they produce for the country. They just didn't stop. Their model at 1.3 million liters a day with 2,500 families makes about a 20 herd cow per family average. So they put a model together for families. And it blesses my heart and theirs. Someone started the vision, somebody planted, somebody watered, and the 2,500 families are the ones that are harvesting. But it is a fairly different system than what you would find in a dairy operation up here. They need to work together. You have all of these little families that have 3 or 5 hectares. And some of the big farmers provide all the silage and the hay. We went out and watched them. They were making silage. They had the latest and the greatest silage cutter. They could fill a big dump, semi-dump, in probably 10, 15 minutes. Like, it was amazing how fast. They couldn't even go around the field one time without being full. And we followed them over to this little family farm, and the man had a day job as well. They filled his silo up, his trench silo, and so he had his silage for the whole year for his little cow herd. The colony has a feed mill, they provide the feed. And then, of course, there's some other farmers that provide the hay. Why? Is because their families love how their children can get up, have some responsibility, take care of some cows, take care of some calves, and they have something to do while they're working. But it takes a tremendous amount of working together. But that's the model they have, and they can produce milk at the price that the imports, if someone wanted to import milk, they can't, because the milk is produced at the right price in the country. I have went to so many countries that, we can't produce because we have all these imports coming in and they're cheaper than what we can raise it here. No, just figure out how to raise it for the same price here. That's not hard. There's other people doing it. We can't. Okay, imports will come in. If you can't produce for your country, the political system has to keep milk on the table for their people. If nobody in the country produces it, it will be imported. And the governments actually kind of like it because they can control all the profits that's made off on the imports. So what did they do? They just kept producing. Once the country was full, they started exporting. How do they export it? Most of it exported in powdered milk. They are in the plans of putting up another powdered milk factory, which will let them process 1.75 million liters a day powder. So you can take a little country, produce twice as much, figure out a way how to do it that is same price as everybody else, and you get to export. So there is a whole lot of models out there that work. And I have just thanked the Lord that I have been able to be part of that. I never expected that I would be part of an organization that has a vision, and with business people here in the U.S. that have a vision to stop the cycle of what us young boys just about always do. And that's, we end up back in the U.S. because there's no financial opportunities, or used to not be financial opportunities in those countries. Recently had the privilege of sitting with a family from Africa. They've been serving there 15 years and their son is 17 years old. And I emailed him this frequently asked questions. Maybe you can pass those out as well. I just printed some copies out. You can have these on email as well. I sent him a copy of this, and he said when I got done reading with this, now I'm not saying this for any glory or whatever. He said when I got done reading that, he said, I told my son, this is exactly what we need. We have to meet with Roman when we go back home for furlough. And so he called me up and we spent a day together. We met in Holmes County, Ohio, or up there in Northern Ohio, and we sat down. And the father's greatest fear was, my son is gonna have to come back to the U.S. because we still have not figured out how to make a living in Africa. And is there any way that Asal thinks that we can figure it out? And we said, well, we'll be more than happy to join in to see if we can make life sustainable in Africa. So that is some of the challenges that we face. And the closing statement here, from age 14 to 17, I didn't have any brothers, I just had sisters. But those were the three most loneliest years in my life, from age 14 to 17. I didn't have anyone to talk to. We all didn't have much resources. The church wasn't quite sure. And their only solution was, you're gonna have to go back to the States. Like, what else is there to do? The rest of us don't have much either. But neither did they have really any, like there was no organization, there was nothing there to help us. And when I shared my story with a man from Uruguay, he just broke down and cried. He said, that is probably the thing I have struggled with most, is we're out here and it seems like we have no one to talk to from back in the U.S. side. No one that even remotely kind of understands. Yeah, they can talk, but it just seems like when I told him my story, that from age 14 to 17 was probably the three most loneliest years in my life. And so it's been very interesting for me as communication officer of ASAL, is somehow we have that connection because they know I went through it and they're going through it. And just the thing of knowing that there is somebody that cares, there's an organization that's actually been formed to address this. This well-digging thing that we have said it won't work and it gets kept getting taken away. We've tried 50 plus years digging these wells. Well, can we be like Isaac? Keep digging till there's room in the land. May God bless.